Today on Family Talk.
Our public education system is so abominable because every state constitution says that public education is to train students for active and informed citizenship, participatory citizenship. In the last election, in the last presidential election, 2012, 70% of those who voted did not know the Constitution was the supreme law of the land. 65% of voters did not know what judges are supposed to do. Now grab this, 62% of those who voted in the 2012 presidential election could not name the three branches of government. Now, that's after 12 years of school, and you've got 62% that can't name three branches. And let me throw one other number out. Of those who hold office right now, 48% of those in office cannot name the three branches of government.
Oh my goodness, it still amazes me that so many people don't know or understand our own government. No wonder our country is in trouble. Hi everyone, and welcome to Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, along with our host, psychologist and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. Today we're going to continue our conversation with David Barton, a well-known speaker and author who is also the founder of Wall Builders, a national pro-family organization that emphasizes America's moral, religious, and constitutional heritage. We ended day one of this program by discussing how a lot of our leaders don't know the very Constitution that they swore to serve and protect when they were elected into office. David Barton shared a story of interacting with a congressman who was unwilling to put through legislation related to supporting the family because he thought the separation of church and state was in the First Amendment, which it's not. Today we're going to build on our conversation about the Constitution and explore more details on the amazing men who not only created the Constitution, but helped lay the foundation of our country. So here now is David Barton and my dad, Dr. James Dobson, on today's edition of Family Talk.
David, the Founding Fathers that gave us this wonderful system of government and wrote the Constitution and all the foundational documents and so on. Those were incredibly gifted men,
yeah,
weren't they?
They were.
Have you ever thought about how they all came together almost as a class at a given time?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to see the hand of the Lord in this. At about the same time, France was beheading everybody. Mm-hmm. Here we are moving toward freedom and a representative form of government. Mm-hmm. How did that happen here, but didn't happen in the nations of Europe?
Mm. One of the answers to that is given by the British and is confirmed by the Americans. And the British blamed the American preachers for the American Revolution. They called them the Black Robe Regiment because all the preachers wore black robes. And so you look at the behavior of the British when they came to America in the Revolution. For example, when they landed in New York City in 1777, there were 19 churches in New York City. They burned 10 of them to the ground. They desecrated the other nine.
Wow.
They went across New Jersey burning churches, across Virginia burning churches. You will find that while we had 4,335 Americans lose their life to British bullets, we had 11,500 lose their lives in prisoner of war camps, in British prisoner of war camps. And the highest attrition rate was among preachers. If the British got a preacher, he ain't coming out because he's the guy responsible for this. What you'll find is that in the Declaration of Independence, we start with 155 words that set forth the six principles of American government. We follow with 27 grievances showing the violation of those rights. Historians have documented every single right set forth in the Declaration of Independence had been preached in the American pulpit by 1763. So the Declaration of Independence is nothing more than listening to sermons we've been hearing in church. When you look at the first skirmish in the American Revolution, the Battle of Lexington, it was all done by one church. The 70 Americans who took on the 700 British, it was the church of the Reverend Jonas Clark who went out to defend Lexington from the British. You look at the leader forces in New Jersey, it's the Reverend James Caldwell. You look at one of Washington's major generals, it's the Reverend John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg. I mean, the church is responsible for what America was.
When we think of the Founding Fathers, you know, Washington, Adams, Patrick Henry, Benjamin Rush, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and the others, they were so gifted. Were they influenced by the aftermath of the first Great Awakening that occurred in this country? Because there was a religious theme to all this. And I mean, not all of those men were committed Christians, but all of them were influenced by it.
You know, it's a great question. And let me touch on the Great Awakening for just a moment, because it's a 40-year revival. People don't think of revivals in terms of decades. The Great Awakening went from 1730 to 1770. It had not one preacher. It had a dozen huge preachers in it. You had George Whitfield, obviously. You had Wesley involved with it. But you also had Asbury. You had Coke. You had Samuel Cooper, Jonathan Mayhew, Gilbert Tennant, Samuel Davies. And they were all regional, really important regional guys. For example, you look at the guy who is really important in the Great Awakening in the Virginia region. His name is Samuel Davies. He is reported to be the best pulpit preacher in American history. Well, little Samuel Davies, when he was preaching all over that central part of the country, had a little kid running around with him that was just always hanging on his heels, going everywhere he went. And up in New England, in Massachusetts, Samuel Cooper was the guy who was the huge voice in the Great Awakening. And he had a little kid running around on his heels all the time. And in Pennsylvania, Gilbert Tennant was the preacher there all over Pennsylvania, Great Awakening. He had a little kid running around with him. Well, the kid that was running around with Samuel Davies is a little kid named Patrick Henry. Now, I wonder where Patrick Henry learned those great oratorical skills from the best preacher in American history. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at Samuel Cooper, the kid running around his heels is a little guy named John Adams. And then when you look at Gilbert Tennant, the kid running around his heels is a little guy named Benjamin Rush. And you start saying, wow, all these guys were mentored by Great Awakening folks. And so when the British came into Williamsburg and they took 200 British soldiers, took all these things out of Williamsburg that they were not supposed to take even under British law, Patrick Henry gets 5,000 Virginia farmers. They grab their guns and they go after those 200 British guys. But before they did, Patrick Henry got them all around a big boulder. He crawled up on the top of that boulder in the middle of the pasture and he preached them a sermon out of Exodus 21. So here's Patrick Henry preaching sermons to these farmers before they go after, and they surrounded the British. They got everything back. Not a shot was fired, but you have all of this coming out of the Great Awakening. The other thing about the Great Awakening is if you look at George Whitfield, who is the prominent guy in the Great Awakening, he's the guy who came up with the first military insignia and military motto. He started telling the Americans, if you guys are going to protect your liberties, you're going to have to separate from Great Britain. So when he died in 1770, they buried him in a church in Newburyport. As the Massachusetts militia was marching out in 1775, they went to that church and Chaplain Spring preached a sermon over the body, the sarcophagus of George Whitfield, to all the Massachusetts military. Then they went downstairs, they lifted off the sarcophagus. There is Whitfield's bones, arms crossed, but he has his clerical robes on. And all the soldiers cut a piece off of Whitfield's robe to take with them in the battle. They cut a piece off his robe because he's the father of the American Revolution. Nobody thinks about that today. But yeah, that's the answer to your question. The American Revolution was birthed out of the Great Awakening.
How do you explain the ragtag army of farmers and uneducated men and who knows who else, tag-alongs, mm-hmm. that beat the most powerful nation on earth in the British military? How did that happen? Was that by divine decree, or did these men have something that we don't know about?
Both. God uses people to do his work. If we're praying for revival and expect God to sweep in and suddenly change everybody's heart, it's not going to happen. He sends people to change people's heart. He's waiting on us. He's always used his ministers to touch people. He's always used his faithful people to touch others. He's always used soldiers to win wars. Although God will intervene, he still has soldiers. So it takes both. I think that the two answers are, one is our Americans back then had a different attitude. And I think I can best explain it by going to what George Washington did with the first Federal Thanksgiving Proclamation. In that first Federal Thanksgiving Proclamation, he did it because they had, on that day, finished the American Bill of Rights, which is the capstone of the Constitution. So Washington called the first Federal Thanksgiving Day because we finished the Constitution, which by itself, that's pretty remarkable. He thought that was something to thank God over. And they had a discussion on the floor of Congress, by the way, out of 2 Chronicles chapters 5 through 7 on why they should have a public day of Thanksgiving. So Washington declared a day of Thanksgiving. And in the first line of that proclamation, he tells Americans why we are having a day of Thanksgiving. This is his quote. He says, "It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will, to be grateful for his benefits, and humbly to implore his protection and favor." Now, the word I want to hit there is the word duty, because the word duty means something then it does not mean today. And the word duty then was a legally binding contractual obligation. That's what it meant. In 1913, the definition of duty was changed to a responsibility. And if you look up the definition today, it says that which one ought to do. Well, back then, it's a legally binding contractual obligation. And so duty was everything. When you had a legally binding contractual obligation to acknowledge God for what he'd done for America, that's not just something we ought to do. And that sense of duty is what drove those soldiers. That's why back in that day, if you challenged someone's word, if you called them a liar, you would find yourself in a duel because you have challenged the essence of who they are. Their duty was, I gave my word to protect my family, my country, and my home. If I go out there and get myself killed, that's no sweat because I gave my word and I won't break my word. That comes out of a teaching that Jesus did in Luke 17 where the disciples said, Lord, we've been watching you do miracles. We can't do them. We prayed for this kid. It didn't get healed. What do we do? The answer to their question of, Lord, increase our faith, Jesus told them a parable about how to do your duty. And so duty is always associated with spiritual maturity. When you do things you don't want to do simply because it's the right thing to do, and that's why the American Army went 3 years without getting paid. They weren't out there because they were paid warriors. They're out there sacrificing.
In fact, they lost for year and a half.
They did not win major campaigns until Yorktown. They survived for 7 years, and they won skirmishes and small battles and little things. And by a war of attrition, they end up trapping the British. And I can show you founder after founder after founder who said it was God's hand. And if you look at the instance that happened in the Revolution, like when the British early on Long Island got George Washington trapped on Long Island, all the Continental Army, the British should have gone right in and crushed Washington. And they said, he's on the island, he can't get off, let's just all take a rest, we'll get him in the morning. Well, they take a rest, dumb thing to do. A fog comes in, covers the entire Continental Army, separates the British from the Army. They can't see the American Army. Washington goes, gets everybody he can. He gets the Americans off the island, and the fog lifts as the British see the last boat going out over the horizon. There were so many times God sent weather to help the Americans. There were so many times, but they also had character. They had biblical character. Their chaplains were key to what they did. The Bible reading was key to what they did. There's a spiritual element, but there's an element that God also expects from us, and that's the character.
There's so many stories from that era that are inspirational. And what a shame that today's young people have never heard them. They names of the people. Mm-hmm. I would like you to tell a story of George Washington in the pre-colonial era when he was a commander in the French and Indian War.
Yes.
And got into a terrible battle.
Yes.
And what happened to him? Or better yet, what didn't happen?
In the French and Indian War, you had the Americans and the British fighting against the French and the Indians. The Americans and the British were in the colonies on the Atlantic seaboard and all along the inward area, along the river, Mississippi and others, Ohio River. That's where the French and the Indians were. And so the fight is who gets the Ohio Territory between those two. And so the French said, we get it. And the British said, no, it's ours. So the British Crown sent 1,300 troops to America. They joined up with George Washington, who led 100 Virginia Continentals. And those troops went after the 700 French that were in this Fort Duquesne, which is now Pittsburgh. As they drew near, Washington kept telling General Braddock, the head of the British forces, you need to send out scouts. We're in the woods. We'll get attacked. And Braddock says, nobody attacks in the woods. We all wait till we get on an open battlefield. That's how they fought battles in Europe, was on open battlefields. And so as they're about 9 miles from Fort Duquesne, they get ambushed. And when they get ambushed, Washington and his guys immediately take cover in the trees. General Braddock would not let any of his soldiers get behind the trees. He said, that's a coward's way to fight. You stand out here in the bottom ravine and you fire back at them. Well, you can't see who you're shooting at because they're on the tops of trees and behind logs. And so over the next 2 hours, they were slaughtered. The French and Indians lost only 30 casualties, and that was all from Washington's guys. And the British, out of 1,300 troops, lost 714 troops out of 1,300. The British had 86 officers. George Washington was the only officer not shot down off his horse. And that's because the Indians had targeted every officer, knew that they could kill the officers, they could scatter the troops and kill them all later. So when General Braddock was finally shot, Washington has not been shot. He gathered the remaining troops and got them out of there, took them back to Fort Cumberland. And on the 17th of July, 1755, he wrote a letter to his family. He said, you've heard since the battle that we were all destroyed. He said, that's not true. I am alive. He said, but it's by the all-powerful dispensations of providence that I've been protected beyond all human expectation. When he took off his jacket, he had several bullet holes through his jacket. He brushed bullet fragments out of his hair. He had several horses shot from under him. So he, if it was me and I take my jacket off and I got bullet holes in my jacket, I'm going to look for leaks somewhere. I mean, you look for bullet. But he said, and one letter he wrote said, the miraculous care of Providence. So he recognized that. But the rest of the story happens 15 years later. After the battle's long over and gone, he comes back to those same woods. He's now in a part of Virginia that is now West Virginia. And as he was camped there in a time of peace, several Indian chiefs came to him and approached him and said, we want to counsel with you. And so they sat around a fire, and they looked at Washington and said, you don't know us, but 15 years ago, you and I were in this woods together. And one of the chiefs said, we saw you. We knew that if we could shoot you down like the other officers, we could scatter the troops. So I told my braves to single you out and fire at you. He said, I personally fired my rifle at you 17 different times. He said, my rifle had never before been known to miss, but I could not bring you down. Another chief, Red Hawk, said, I fired at you 13 times. Another one said 11 times. And so all these chiefs had targeted him and could not kill him. And their closing statement was, we have come all this way to meet the man that God would not let die in battle. Now, Samuel Davies, that I mentioned a minute ago, the great preacher in Virginia, he preached a sermon after hearing about what happened to George Washington in 1755. And in that sermon, I've got the original sermon. It says, in that sermon, he said, we've all heard about this young man named George Washington. Don't know much about him. But when God intervenes in a miraculous way to protect a man like that, it's probable that God probably has something for that young man to do in the future. Mm. Well, yeah, duh. You know, he becomes the father of the country. So Washington openly acknowledges it's God. God saved him, and Washington was very grateful for it and openly acknowledged that throughout his life.
With all you know about that era, our founding fathers in the early days of this country, what is it doing to you now to witness the departure from all those principles that made us great? You know, I hear this everywhere I go. There's people who are familiar with what happened and have read your books and others are in despair because they look at it and they say, what is Barack Obama doing to us? And not just him, but perhaps the majority of the leaders in Washington are taking us as far away from all that made us great as they possibly can. Is that gnawing on your soul?
No. It's something different that bothers me. I'm not at all disturbed by what Barack Obama is doing. I'm not at all disturbed by what Harry Reid is doing. And I don't say that in a light way. Let me explain why. Since 1980, every president that's been elected was elected by only one out of six American adults. Five out of six American adults did not vote for Barack Obama. So I'm ticked at the others that didn't. See, what happens is when you look at all the Constitution, if you're 18 years and above, you can vote. Now, you have to register to vote, but only 67.1% of American adults register to vote. So already we've told one-third of Americans, say, we don't care who the president is. So you've taken one-third off the table. Now, of the two-thirds that are left to register to vote, in any given presidential election since 1980, Ronald Reagan, only 57.1% of the registrars vote. So 57.1% of 67.1%, we're talking now at 33% of the nation votes in an election. Well, it only takes a majority to win, so 17% wins. So 17% of the nation elected Barack Obama. That means five out of six Americans did not vote for President Obama. I'm ticked at the ones who didn't vote at all. I'm ticked at the ones who sat on the sideline. We got exactly what we deserved when only one out of six chose the president.
Why do you think there's such apathy?
There's apathy for, I think, several reasons. One is Christians have the worst voter turnout percentage of any group. Christians vote less than any other.
Has it always been that way?
No, it has always been the opposite way. We got into a pietism in the 1920s that says, oh, Christians, you want to do something good for God? Be a pastor, be a missionary, but don't get in secular stuff like medicine or law or government or education or science.
Or entertainment.
Or entertainment. Get out of all those. And so by the 1950s, we had abandoned all those areas. And of course, if Christians aren't going to run it, non-Christians will. And so why would you object to having non-Christian values when Christians refuse to be part of it? So this is something that happened particularly in the 30s. There were three political setbacks that happened in the 1920s and 30s that caused church leaders to start screaming, and they did. And so we're still stuck with that today. I work with an organization We have the largest database in the United States of voters. We have over 220 million voters. And so out of that database, we have created all sorts of widgets and all sorts of little things to check. And what we'll do very often is we can check any pastor's list, any church list out there. And we'll get large mega churches say, man, I really emphasize voting. I tell my people to go, well, we have voter registration pews. And so we will take the church roll of that church and bump it up against the voter registration list and the voter bump it up against the voting list. And generally, even in the churches that are most active, you get about 25% of the members that actually voted in the election. So 3 out of 4 Christians do not vote in most elections, and that's in the most active churches. Only 14% of churches actually put out a voter guide in their church. So you're looking at 7 of 8 churches won't even put out information for their citizens on how to vote. So it's really Christians that are more responsible for this. Yeah. Now, for the Christians who voted against Barack Obama, they're really ticked off. But I'm not ticked off at the 1 out of 6. I'm ticked off at the 5 of 6, and I can't even say that because 2 of the 6 voted. 1 voted for him, 1 voted against him. Before, the 6 didn't vote at all. And that's the ones that we really have to focus on. And until they change it. So part of it is the church teaches wrong things. Another part is our public education system is so abominable because every state constitution says that public education is to train students for active and informed citizenship, participatory citizenship. In the last election, in the last presidential election, 2012, 70% of those who voted did not know the Constitution was the supreme law of the land. 65% of voters did not know what judges are supposed to do. Now grab this. 62% of those who voted in the 2012 presidential election could not name the 3 branches of government. Now, that's after 12 years of school, and you've got 62% that can't name 3 branches. And let me throw one other number out. Of those who hold office right now, 48% of those in office cannot name the 3 branches of government.
Oh, come on.
No, for real. For real. 48% of those in office cannot name the 3 branches of government.
That's breathtaking.
We may have dumb leaders, we got stupid people. And I don't say that lightly. It's because we don't even know what our own government is. I mean, we don't know the Bible. We don't know what our own government is. We would much rather be doing something than voting. Let's watch a TV program. Let's do a game. And until we get the sense of duty that we had in the founding era that says, you know what, I have a duty to vote. I don't care if I like any of them or not. I will vote. Nobody's going to keep me from voting for the best person that's on the ticket, whether I like them or not. I will vote. Until we get that sense of duty back, it's going to be hard to get the nation back.
Well, I ask you if you are agitated by the poor quality of leaders we have. Let me ask you a related question. How can we long endure without a knowledge of government and our history and of the spiritual component to it that really was the foundation for it? Where are we headed?
Yeah.
You know, does that agitate you?
We're headed, I think, in a good direction, literally. And, you know, I mentioned that I'll address 600 groups a year. Well, I've got 6 guys on my staff, and we travel and speak. That means a lot of people are wanting to hear this stuff. You know, I would be really worried if we had all this information and nobody wanted to hear it. But people want to hear it. And I look at what happened on the New York Times bestseller list. I've had a book on the New York Times bestseller list on Thomas Jefferson. Glenn Beck had one on George Washington. Newt Gingrich had one on Valley Forge and Trenton. David McCullough had one on John Adams. People are willing to pay money to learn what they were supposed to learn in school. So you got people willing to go out and pay money to learn history that they were supposed to learn in school. That's a good sign.
Wow, this program really puts into perspective the idea of an educated voter. If people don't know the 3 branches of government, how can we expect them to understand the important issues our nation is facing or to be able to do the research to discover who the good candidates are? You've been listening to the second part of a very informative program with David Barton here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, and if you'd like more information about David Barton or his book, The Founder's Bible, visit our website at drjamesdobson.org or call us at 877-732-6825. And if you enjoyed today's program, you can continue the conversation on Facebook by visiting the Family Talk Facebook page and commenting on or sharing the post about this broadcast. We love to know what you think about our content and of our radio program, as well as what these programs mean to you. So thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you again next time for Part 3, the conclusion of our conversation with David Barton, right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Meg Meeker for Family Talk, and I want to let you know about a very special offer that we have handpicked for you for the month of July. Raising a strong-willed child is difficult, but it's not impossible. I know that it often feels that way, especially when your son looks at you in the face and hits his sister one more time, or when your daughter goes behind your back and recruits her unwitting dad to go against your wishes. But I'm here to tell you that you can be a successful mom or dad and raise your strong-willed child into a successful adult. And to show you how serious we are at Family Talk that you can do this, for every donation we receive this month, we will send you not only Dr. James Dobson's book, The New Strong-Willed Child, but also the corresponding DVD from the brand new Building a Family Legacy series. Both are yours when you give today by calling us at 877-732-6825 or by visiting our website, drjamesdobson.org. Thank you for supporting us and for standing on behalf of families. And as always, thank you for listening to Family Talk.